Monday, March 4th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. Trump, that be Donald J., wins 9-0 at the Supreme Court. You can't take the man off the ballot. He's going to lose his immunity case, that's true. I would wager that, but that will be too late to bring the one trial that most jeopardizes his status as a candidate. So, what do we got to look forward to? Unfazed by shame, uninterested in coherence, go forth, he must, so saith the Supreme Court. Here was Donald Trump at a rally in Richmond, Virginia over the weekend.
And Putin, you know, has so little respect for Obama that he's starting to throw around the nuclear word today. You heard that, nuclear. He's starting to talk nuclear weapons today. I was waiting for that to happen. But we have a fool as a president.
Obama, he mistook Joe Biden for Obama. Joe Biden himself made a mistake or two. Here was Joe Biden talking about aid to not Ukraine, but Israel.
In the coming days, we're going to join with our friends in Jordan and others in providing airdrops of additional food and supplies into Ukraine and seek to continue to open up other avenues into Ukraine, including the possibility of a Marine corridor to deliver large amounts of humanitarian assistance.
Wow. If these two guys get into a debate, one is going to threaten the South Korean missile program, and in response, the other is going to vow to rush aid to the North Macedonians. We have a lot of countries, you know, that remind people of other countries. Iran and Iraq, to name two, with a 75% overlap alphabetically, but not too much geopolitically. You know, ally, horrible rival, Sunni Shia, that sort of thing. I'm just saying, let's build in, I don't know, a 5-minute buffer before lowering DEFCON status. Whoever is the DEFCON guy, and there is a DEFCON, maybe it's a DEFCON gal. It's like whoever has that final decree where they go flip the switch, it's definitely a toggle switch from the 70s. Just give it a couple more minutes to make sure which country he was actually talking about, whoever the he is. Wait, did you mean Taiwan or Thailand? Well, I know sometimes Trump says Thailand, but we want to get this one clear. There's no reason to scramble the jets to protect Thailand. I don't think Laos was insulting King Mahawacharya Longkorn. I could be wrong. Anyway, both of these fine fellows, full steam ahead, I say, barring a late-breaking Nikki Haley or Dean Phillips surge. Both of their names will be on the ballot in every state of the union, from the most populous California to the least, say, South Dakota or its neighbor, North Korea. On the show today, we shall talk about a report in The Intercept that talked about a report in The New York Times, the effect of which has caused a kerfuffle at the latter news organization, but, in my estimation, does not seriously question the actual facts that were reported. But first, on February 13th, the Republican-controlled House voted to impeach Homeland Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. Huge news, except not really. In the February 23rd edition of The New Yorker, reporter Jonathan Blitzer wrote up his lengthy profile of Mayorkas. The title of that piece was The Trials of Alejandro Mayorkas. The Secretary of Homeland Security has been forced to respond to an unprecedented flow of migrants to the U.S. border. Why are Republicans in Congress impeaching him for it? Oh, you should listen to the whole interview. It's great. In fact, we're playing it in two parts. But I'll answer the question here. Why are the Republicans in Congress impeaching him for it? Because they can. Jonathan Blitzer, up next. The Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, has been impeached, not threatened to be impeached, not a vote to refer impeachment articles to committee. He has been impeached. And I know you as listeners of The Gist, you almost certainly know this, but there is a chance you don't, maybe a bigger chance than I would have thought, a secretary, a cabinet secretary, for the first time since 1876, has been impeached. And it is being treated as if this is going to go nowhere and there's nothing to it. Now, I've looked very hard at the charges as they are against Alejandro Mayorkas, and I have to agree with that. I don't see much evidence that this will go much of anywhere else or that the charges are anything other than political theater. But that doesn't mean that the tension that Mayorkas is facing and that the critiques of Mayorkas have no validity. An excellent, expansive article in a recent issue of The New Yorker by Jonathan Blitzer entitled Border Troubles Shadowed Mayorkas for a While, talks all about his tenure. The author of that article, Jonathan Blitzer, joins me now. Jonathan, welcome to The Gist.
Thanks so much for having me.
First, I don't even know if during the rest of the interview we'll talk much about impeachment. Is there any possibility or is there anything more substantive? And I didn't get it. If you know the answer to this, it didn't shine through in the article, so I'm going to assume there's not much there. But is there anything of substance that could come out and actually cost Mayorkas his job?
No, there isn't. There's no substance in the charges against him. There is no concrete suggestion of wrongdoing or malfeasance in any specific way. It's more a general gripe with the Biden administration's immigration policies. And it had been decided fairly early on in this Congress, frankly, among the Republicans, that this was a relatively safe target for them to go after. I mean, there was more division earlier on. Things have obviously gotten more extreme in the Republican conference. But initially, there was this idea that, trying to impeach Biden would be too much. We have to kind of bide our time and pace ourselves. And there was this feeling from the earliest days of the Biden administration that Mayorkas was kind of an easy, relatively soft target. But that's what this is. I mean, this is a purely political maneuver that's meant to just shine a light on the Biden administration's immigration policies, which is obviously a real vulnerability for Biden and therefore makes total political sense, I suppose, for the Republicans to try to push this line with the impeachment.
And fill me in if there's anything else here, and then we'll get off the actual impeachment thing, but onto the substance of his challenges. As I read it, the deeds that he's being impeached for are not doing his job, where there is a big question about if that's even an impeachable offense, a high crime or misdemeanor, and also lying to the committee. But if you look over his lies were asserting things like, I am doing my job.
Right. So to start with the second thing first, the kind of allegation that he's lied to congressional committees. I mean, they have been obsessed from the very beginning with kind of terminology, and they've tried he's appeared more than any other cabinet secretary before Congress. The last I checked, it was 27 times, which is just vastly more appearances in front of Congress than anyone else. And in each of these sessions, he gets badgered about, you know, whether or not what we're seeing at the border is a crisis, quote unquote crisis. How would you define crisis? And on and on. And then relatedly, whether or not a kind of particular phrase that the Republican inquisitors in this impeachment charade got obsessed with was this idea of operational security of the border. Is the border secure? And, you know, you're badgering the secretary of the Department of Homeland Security in a hearing. He's going to tell you the border is secure. But they're trying to play with this idea that he claimed it was secure when it in some ways maybe couldn't be said to be secure. And they're like trying to play this sort of semantic game with them. I don't think there's really any substance or meaning there. The one thing that like vaguely intersects with actual immigration policy and sort of which kind of caught my eye and is interesting, vis-a-vis the Senate negotiations, which we can talk about, is this idea specifically what they're levying against him, this charge, is that he's deliberately not enforcing the law. Now, like in one sense, obviously that's absurd. I mean, just plain and simple, that's absurd. They're holding up the fact that there are releases of migrants into the country because of limited resources as evidence that the Biden administration is deliberately flouting the law, which is just not the truth. Mm-hmm. But one of the things the Biden administration has done, and we can talk about this in more detail, that is actually quite interesting and I think significant under the circumstances, is it's introduced a program to parole in migrants from four countries whose populations have really grown and surged at the southern border over the last couple of years. And this is the subject of a lot of partisan bile and opposition, this idea that one of the administration's responses to this pressure at the border is to open up legal pathways for people to come. And so when they claim that, you know, Mayorkas and DHS are deliberately flouting the law, the point where that roughly intersects with reality is in relation to this parole program. And so right. It's not, they're not totally firing blanks. I mean, there's there is an actual kind of controversial policy discussion that can be had around these issues, but they're obviously blowing it up just to maximize the political damage.
Right. So let's talk about this not through the lens of what Nancy Mace or Mark Green would allege about Mayorkas. The four countries that have this parole policy from South and Central America are Venezuela, Haiti, Cuba, and Nicaragua. But those aren't the only four countries. It was started with Ukraine. And in fact, I'll disclose, we hosted and some of my listeners donated to a Ukrainian family who came in to the country through the parole policy. Now, let's talk about, and that wasn't terribly controversial when it was America allowing these victims of the Ukraine war in. And basically what parole does is it's more of a path to allow people in and to allow them to work, which is very important to, well, them being here and being able to have productive lives, and also the mayors who've had many of these migrants thrust upon them really are advocating for them to be able to work and have their working papers. And that's part of the parole system, right?
Absolutely. So what you're describing, and that's I'm so glad that you make that point about Ukraine, because basically there's a sort of a long arc to how the administration came to this parole vision for helping to relieve pressure at the southern border. And like the kind of key inflection point, as you point out, were Ukrainians who were showing up in northern Mexico at the U.S. southern border at the start of the Ukraine war. And the administration recognized that actually there was a pretty vast network of Americans who were willing to help sponsor these individuals and help, you know, facilitate their entry into the United States. That even had an antecedent in the Afghan withdrawal effort. When you had, you know, something like, I can't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but something like 77,000 Afghans who received parole in the United States after their evacuation when the Taliban retook control of the country in 2021. And one of the things the administration saw very clearly during that whole effort was that there was a real sense of enthusiasm, actually, and kind of meaningfully, to be frank, among Americans who wanted to help, you know, provide for people who had been uprooted and who in these states of emergency needed to gain entry into the United States. And so you kind of had a few points, historical points, over the course of the Biden administration, where the administration started to recognize that, okay, there are actually orderly ways that we can combine volunteers, the parole authority that's existed in the United States since the Eisenhower era, to allow people into the country during moments of international emergency. And we can begin maybe to provide a more orderly sort of path for them to get into the country, to start working, to get on their feet. And that ended up getting applied a little bit later on to these four populations, where for a couple of reasons, you were seeing huge numbers at the southern border. For one thing, you know, Venezuela has been in a state of collapse now for years. We've not seen kind of the likes of mass migration out of Venezuela for decades. I mean, millions of people have left the country since 2014, 2015. And part of what we're seeing now is that people, Venezuelans, who had resettled elsewhere over the years, because of the fallout of COVID and other things going on in South and Central America, have gotten uprooted again. Huge numbers of people, obviously an acute political need and a humanitarian need to deal with this population at the southern border. Until very recently, the government of Venezuela, and this is also true of the governments of Nicaragua and Cuba, refused to accept American deportation flights. And so there was a diplomatic emergency as well that really made it imperative for the administration to find ways of dealing with this population at the southern border and relieving pressure on American resources there. So,
right. But my question about that is, I know that there were many more objections. In fact, I didn't hear too many objections to the Ukrainian policy or the Afghan policy. Afghan was seen as, you know, that's the you break it, you bought it type conception. And one could argue that Venezuela, Haiti, Nicaragua, all of these, for reasons the United States foreign policy influenced what happened in their country, a lot more complicated and less straightforward than Afghanistan. But my question is, we could say they're relieving pressure at the southern border, but is just plucking hundreds of thousands of people and saying, okay, you're in now, is that really what most Americans think of as relieving pressure? Yes, they have less pressure to get in because we just let them in.
Well, I'm glad you put it that way, because I think there are basically two broad ways to think about it. The first is this: Congress has refused to act in any basic way. And that's been the case now for decades. And so, you know, the problem that we have at the border, that we've had over successive administrations, not just the Biden administration, although obviously it's gotten to kind of an extreme point, is that the asylum system at the southern border has sort of had to pick up the slack for the entirety of the legal immigration system that has not been updated in decades, and that really kind of absurdly under the circumstances hasn't allowed people to come into the United States legally, to reunite with family members, to come on work visas, to address labor shortages that are rampant across the United States. And so you basically have a dead zone in Congress. You have the fact that the asylum system, which was created for a very specific purpose, is now basically being used by anyone who's desperate to reach opportunity or protection in the United States to enter the country. And it's not sustainable in any sense. So under the circumstances, if you're the Biden administration, you know, what do you do? Your resources are limited. When you've tried to get more money and resources to the border, just with basic funding proposals, you know, more agents, more Border Patrol agents, more asylum officers, more immigration judges, more spaces for holding people while processing them as they first arrive. When all of those requests are rejected, the tools are relatively limited. And one of the tools that the executive has is this parole authority. And the idea was, from the administration's perspective, we can kind of incentivize people to come in a more orderly way. Mm-hmm. If we create these legal pathways, we'll cap the number of people from these countries who can come each month. And hopefully, one of the consequences will be, if we tighten enforcement between ports of entry, we can kind of like rewire a little bit how people game out this strategy of coming to the United States and get them to come in an orderly, legal fashion rather than showing up at the southern border and kind of just creating more and more problems for the government to deal with. So one of the consequences of this, I have to say, and it's significant, is that in the first year of this big parole program for those four nationalities, the number of the percentage drop in arrivals of Venezuelans, Nicaraguans, Cubans, and Haitians, 91%. In 1 year, that's a significant drop. But to your second point, and this is a profound thing, those people who get paroled into the United States, they have a temporary legal status. That is not a path to citizenship. That is not a sustained path for a future life in the United States. It is an immediate ticket in and an opportunity to work legally, both no small things. But to your question, yes, this is very much an open question. What happens, you know, 5-10 years down the road when, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are paroled into the United States and there isn't an obvious legislative mechanism to normalize their status?
Right. Well, the answer might be to look to the past, because there are other populations in the country who have been allowed to have a temporary status, and it keeps getting renewed and renewed and renewed. And I know the Trump administration tried to reverse that for some of the populations, and it caused a huge hue and cry. Understandably, this would be a horrible humanitarian consequence for these people, but that might serve to answer your question, right?
Well, you know, it's striking. So you're referring to temporary protected status, to TPS. Yeah. And, you know, it's incredible to see the history of TPS in the United States, because, you know, in the pre-Trump universe, what you had was kind of broad bipartisan recognition that those populations needed to be protected, needed to have this sort of avenue opened to them. And so you'd have successive Democratic and Republican administrations every 2 years renewing TPS status for hundreds of thousands of people living in the United States. The reason they had to keep renewing their status was because Congress was so deadlocked that there was no opportunity to actually create more durable legal pathways for those people. And so you kind of have this weird split screen through all of it, where until Trump kind of blew up this whole, you know, sort of whatever precarious balance on the Republican side of things, there was kind of a grudging understanding that, look, we need to kind of quietly and discreetly renew TPS for people and just kind of hope for the best in Congress, even though this issue is so hopelessly partisan and politicized that there's not really any resolution in sight. And so that's how you get people, you know, for me, for instance, I spend a lot of time reporting on Salvadorans living in the United States, mm-hmm. That's the largest population of TPS holders in the United States. TPS for them began, I mean, it's a complicated and interesting history, but it essentially began in the early 2000s as a result of an earthquake in El Salvador. And the people now over 200,000 Salvadorans have TPS. And the average amount of time that Salvadoran TPS holders have had that status is more than 20 years.
Yeah.
So that's a huge amount of time. And as you can imagine, people set down roots. They have children who are born here. Those children are American citizens. You have these kind of, you know, families where now there are different legal statuses under the same roof. It's a very complicated, messy reality that, you know, because of the U.S. political system, we've just sort of come to live with and accept as the messiness attendant on dealing with immigration issues. But it's complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. And when the people in Congress and in the Senate, when gangs of eight or four, or however many of the gangs, the adults in the room know that they can never get some comprehensive immigration reform, but they work on a deal, the conception being this is what we have to do to allow these to avoid terrible humanitarian situations. When that deal, though, gets blown up, even by the dynamics that we've seen now, you know, Mike Johnson taking signals from Donald Trump, it underlines why it's so impossible to get anything done permanently and with the good, sorry, and through the actual non-ad hoc administrative powers of either the executive branch or the legislative branch.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you go back to the last time Congress came close to passing comprehensive immigration reform, it should be said, they came really close. You know, this is 2013, you know, 2013 going into 2014, a comprehensive immigration reform bill that was quite sweeping, should be said, passed the Senate with bipartisan support. And it died on the vine in the House because at the time, John Boehner, the Speaker, refused to bring it to the floor for a vote. And actually, there's an argument that could be made, and I've been persuaded by this argument, that there were, you know, there were a majority of House members who would have, you know, voted to make that reform bill a law. But at the time, it was such a fraught issue for Republicans that it wasn't clear that a majority of the Republican conference supported it. And as a result, Boehner wanted nothing to do with it. And the kind of last gasps of that reform effort coincided with the humanitarian emergency that kind of exploded on the southern border in the spring of 2014, when you had tens of thousands of Central American families and children showing up seeking asylum. And so you kind of had this collision of forces that ultimately kind of conspired against the actual passage of that law. And it was so close, it really was within reach. But you're right. I mean, the result over years and years of this is you have just a series of ad hoc sort of, can they be called solutions? Ad hoc measures that, yeah, that allow
Band-Aids, people to duct tape, whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Especially, yeah.
So it's funny because, well, I don't know if it's funny, but I will note that it's been about 12 minutes in our conversation since we've said the words Alejandro Mayorkas, which was the point of the conversation. Now, this is, though, we haven't wasted anyone's time because you have to understand some of the history of what he was walking into. And he knew all of this. In fact, as you portray the job application, it was Joe Biden asking Mayorkas over and over again, are you sure you want the job? Are you sure you want the job? And he did really want the job. I mean, he, as you portray, he's had this pretty successful career, and he really wanted to. He was positioned to. When he was out of government during the Trump years, he sort of conducted a shadow Homeland Secretary cabinet position, took meetings, positioned himself to get this job. The question is, what did he think? He knows the situation better than anyone else. What did he think he could do in this position?
You know, I think ultimately his view of this was that the job of solving the immigration crisis in the United States is impossible. And so under the circumstances, the best you can hope for is someone who is deeply knowledgeable about the tools that exist inside the executive branch at the DHS level, at the presidential level, to manage a situation that is extraordinarily complicated on a human level, impossibly complicated on a political level. And I think he, in some ways, had this view that he was the best man for the job because he was the best able to withstand all of these pressures and kind of muddle through to some degree, causing the least damage and doing the best sort of possible work that could be imagined under the circumstances. I don't think what he imagined was being vilified personally to the degree that he has. Obviously, being the secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, which presides over the most controversial issue in America, it seems fair to say, is not a pleasant job. You're going to get assailed by, you know, both sides all the time. Every cabinet, every DHS secretary I've talked to over the years, whether it's you know, Michael Chertoff or Janet Napolitano or Jay Johnson, you know, all of them describe basically, you know, you come out, you consider yourself to have done a good job, basically. If you've pissed everyone off and you've hewed more or less to the line you set out for yourself. And so I think that was sort of how he had conceived of this role. And he was particularly well positioned, I should say, on the Democratic side for dealing with what everyone expected to be real pressure from the left on the Biden administration. Because there was a great sense of expectation after the Trump years and you know, during the 2020 campaign, Biden was a quite eloquent campaigner on the value of asylum and restoring humanity to the immigration system. I was struck during the campaign by how forcefully Joe Biden hammered that point home. And so obviously there were very high expectations on the left that the administration would come right in and set everything right. And of course it's much more complicated than that. And I think Mayorkas in an interesting way was someone whose background and credentials positioned him well to sort of break that complicated news to the left as the Biden administration, in theory, really tried to do right by everyone. So I think he went in not necessarily, high-mindedly or overly optimistically. I do think his eyes were open to the kind of politics of it. But I think the bottom fell out faster probably than he expected. The degree to which he has become like the bête noir of the entire Republican Party. And, you know, he goes to a restaurant with his family and people are muttering at him under their breath or shouting at him or flipping him off.
He didn't expect trucks to park outside his home and harass his wife as she walks into and out of the home.
Honestly, in our conversations about that, he's obviously very conscious of how he comes across. He's a pro. He really did seem just frankly befuddled by all of that, by the degree of the personal animus against him. So that's upsetting, honestly.
And that is Jonathan Blitzer, whose New Yorker article about Mayorkas and the U.S.-Mexico border was in their February 23rd issue. We're going to talk more. We're picking the conversation back up where we left off, and that'll be tomorrow. We shall focus on the trade-offs between humanitarian concerns and border enforcement. Don't miss it. And now the spiel. The United Nations today released a report saying that it had found, quote, reasonable grounds to believe that sexual violence occurred against women during the Hamas-led October 7th attack on Israel. And, quote, clear and convincing evidence, end quote, that sexual violence, including rape, sexualized torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment have been committed against the hostages. The UN team conducted its report by reviewing over 5,000 photographs, 50 hours of footage of the attacks. It conducted confidential interviews with survivors and witnesses of the attacks, the released hostages, first responders, health and service providers, among others. It also found a couple of high-profile allegations of rape, which they couldn't confirm, and one that they flat-out said did not happen, and that actually had been reported widely in Israeli media, so it's not a revelation, but it is good that they noted it. There was a section of the report that documented the difficulties in getting to these findings, the credible grounds that rape occurred, and the difficulties included factors like, quote, inaccurate and unreliable forensic interpretations by non-professionals. This is a believable report, not because the UN said so, but because they laid out their methods. Their methods comport with footage that many of us have seen, with eyewitness testimony that many of us have heard, and it comports with the thorough reporting of several news agencies throughout the world, including Reuters, The Guardian, CNN, the AP, and the New York Times. The New York Times, specifically, took months to report the story. And in the end of January, their effort was a major front page piece titled Screams Without Words, How Hamas Weaponized Sexual Violence on October 7th. For months, anti-Israeli press, I'll call it that, including in the U.S. Mondo Weiss and a pretty popular online outlet called The Gray Zone, have been trying to poke holes in the story of the rape of Israeli women. They denigrate and nitpick witnesses, and they elevate the few discredited examples that the UN noted were discredited as standing for the whole. They don't talk about the discredited examples as simply not proper evidence. What they do is they cite it as evidence that widespread rapes did not occur. Now, The Intercept, the leftist online publication, has issued its own very long report, which attempts to cast doubt on the New York Times coverage. So here is what they proved, and they did prove a couple of things. For one of the three bylined reporter, a stringer or freelancer working with the New York Times for the first time on October 7th, did like a tweet on October 7th from an Israeli broadcaster, and that tweet said, among other things, if all the captives are not returned immediately, turn the strip into a slaughterhouse. She, the reporter, has apologized for liking that tweet. The Intercept further reports that, quotes, at least three of her likes have been, meaning likes on Twitter, have been subject to public scrutiny. To The Intercept means that some other Twitter posters criticized her for liking other posts. The other posts are non-offensive and in one case were misdescribed by the person who is doing the criticism, that person being the cartoon avatar of a squirrel. This reporter for the New York Times then went on an Israeli podcast and talked about the process of reporting her story. The Intercept takes that podcast and positions the account as if there were no story of rapes. The Intercept spent a lot of time quoting Israeli medics or first responders who gave inaccurate descriptions of what they found, though none of those inaccurate descriptions were about rape. The Intercept quotes from family members of a victim, and those family members were upset that details of their daughter, their sister's ordeal was made public. The story is, of course, anguishing. Their daughter was killed, and I think reliably it can be reported that she was raped. But The Intercept, quoting the family, cast doubt if she was raped. Not effective doubt, I don't think, because The Intercept only considers the doubts of the family as evidence that the woman wasn't really sexually assaulted. They never really paused to contemplate other reasons why a traditional Israeli family might not want details of their loved one's sexual assault being made public after her murder. I could spend show after show on The Intercept article. I think I might come back a little bit tomorrow, depending on reaction. They do have a scoop, a media scoop of sorts, because The Daily, the New York Times podcast, The Daily, didn't run a podcast version of the story that ran in the print edition. We don't know if it was spiked. We don't know if it was delayed. We don't know why it was delayed. The Intercept has conclusions editorially about why The Daily might have delayed or spiked that report. Now, I realize all of this might be so confusing if you haven't read both long stories, or even if you have, it's sometimes hard to keep your eye on, wait, what did The Times report and what did The Intercept say The Times got wrong? So here's what they call the nut graph. This is what The Intercept says about calling into question about The Times reporting. Here we go. The question has never been whether individual acts of sexual assault may have occurred on October 7th. Rape is not uncommon in war, and there were also several hundred civilians who poured into Israel from Gaza that day in a, quote, second wave, contributing to and participating in the mayhem and violence. The central issue is whether the New York Times presented solid evidence to support its claim that there were newly reported details, quote, establishing that the attacks against women were not isolated events, but part of a broader pattern of gender-based violence on October 7th. The Intercept says that they only were isolated rapes. They weren't part of a pattern, and rape is bound to occur when hundreds of militants stream into civilian areas, like dew on grass in the morning, just a natural outgrowth. But wait, soldiers didn't rape anyone in Afghanistan. U.S. soldiers didn't. They did in Iraq, by the way. And Israeli soldiers aren't raping any women in Gaza. But that aside. So that's what The Intercept says about the New York Times. What did the New York Times say? The New York Times reports that there were more than isolated examples, that there were numerous sexual assaults, and they document several of these sexual assaults. In terms of the scope, I will quote from the New York Times. The Times identified at least seven locations where Israeli women and girls appeared to have been sexually assaulted or mutilated. The Times viewed photographs of one woman's corpse that emergency responders discovered in the rubble of a besieged kibbutz with dozens of nails driven into her thighs and groin. The Times also viewed a video provided by the Israeli military showing two dead Israeli soldiers at a base near Gaza who appear to have been shot directly in their vaginas. And then the Times spent a lot of time talking about specific instances with specific witnesses about specific sexual assaults. The Intercept, by the way, does not dispute the assertions I read. The Intercept didn't address other media Like The Guardian, which reported at least 7 women who were killed were also raped in the attack, according to Professor Ruth Halperin Kaderi, a legal scholar and international rights advocate, of her examination of the evidence so far. The Intercept couldn't have known about, well, they might have known about the impending UN report. They couldn't have known that it would reveal that there was credible evidence of rape. Let's end with 2 pieces of tape. And this doesn't go directly at the allegations. It just goes directly at, I would say, the motivations and what each news outlet wants you to know and how they do their argumentation. The first is The Intercept's Jeremy Scahill. He's appearing on the program Democracy Now! He's asked to comment on a talk that Jeffrey Gettleman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning lead reporter of the New York Times Israel Rape Stories, gave at Columbia. Okay, so first from this Democracy Now! Clip, you'll hear host Amy Goodman setting up the clip from the New York Times reporter. Here we go.
In February, one of the reporters behind the New York Times investigation, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Jeffrey Gettleman, spoke at a conference on conflict-related sexual violence hosted by Columbia University. He talked about the piece.
I did some stories about hostages, and pretty soon, I mean, maybe, I don't know, within the first few days of this attack, we were hearing reports of rape and mutilations of women. We heard it right away. And I don't, maybe people in this room remember those videos of the female soldiers being taken away and the body of that one woman, Shawnee Locke, in the back of a pickup truck, half naked. Right away, it just, there was obviously crimes against women that happened. So because, sadly, I have some experience doing this, I began looking to see what we could find out. And I worked with 2 other colleagues, and we interviewed almost 200 people over the course of 2 months. And what we found, I don't want to even use the word evidence, because evidence is almost like a legal term that suggests you're trying to prove an allegation or prove a case in court. That's not my role. We all have our roles, and my role is to document.
So I wanted to get a response to what he is saying there. He's talking, by the way, to Sheryl Sandberg, the former COO of Meta, Facebook, Jeremy Scahill, if you can talk about what he sees his role as a reporter.
I mean, this is an astonishing comment from Jeffrey Gettleman. I mean, what is he talking about, that it's not the job of journalists to uncover evidence? But for Gettleman to say that it's not the job of journalists to produce evidence, when you're going to say in the middle of a war where civilians are being starved and killed in a operation that is under review now by the International Court of Justice for genocide, if you're going to then make an allegation that Hamas implemented a systematic rape campaign, and you say it's not your job to produce evidence, then what is the job of a journalist in a situation like this?
Okay, that is what The Intercept's Jeremy Scahill made of Gettleman's remark in an equally long clip. Let me now play the full remarks from the moment that Democracy Now! Dipped out of them, thus giving Jeremy Scahill an opportunity to excoriate the speaker who you're about to hear, Jeffrey Gettleman.
I don't want to even use the word evidence, because evidence is almost like a legal term that suggests you're trying to prove an allegation or prove a case in court. That's not my role. We all have our roles, and my role is to document, is to present information, is to give people a voice. And we found information along the entire chain of violence, so of sexual violence. So we found witnesses who were at the rave party, for instance, that saw with their own eyes while this massacre was happening, while people were being slaughtered by the dozens all around them, the people that barely survived this experience, hiding in a ditch or covering themselves with leaves, picking up their head just to see what was happening around them. We found witnesses like that who had seen women being mutilated and being raped in front of their own eyes. We then spoke to soldiers who came into these areas while the fighting was still happening. There was 3,000, an estimate of 3,000 Hamas fighters that came in, heavily armed, good uniforms, radios, very organized. I saw lots of these horrible videos of the attack. And what struck me was how big it was. And they came in as this huge force. And the Israeli military responded too late. But at some point, they got in there, and they're fighting these guys. And the first soldiers into these areas found bodies of women and girls highly suggestive of rape. Then we spoke to more people that came in and found bodies. And as somebody had said on one of these discussions before us, most of the victims who are believed to have been raped were killed. There's a handful of survivors, but not very many at all.
I find that reporting, what you just heard in print and just hearing it from Gettleman, I find it much more trustworthy than the fellow who takes a whole lot of time blowing a gasket over the phrase evidence versus document. I do not see anything in the Intercept story that suggests that the New York Times made significant or really any errors of fact or framing. Maybe I'll be wrong. Maybe they'll correct things. But I don't think the Intercept story gets there from what I can see. There were, in fact, many, many rapes. There were many, many Israeli victims of rape. To say otherwise is dishonest. I'll probably talk more tomorrow about what the word weaponization means, how the word systemic was used by The Intercept when it was never used by The New York Times, and I will talk about the assertion that rape just always happens, passive voice, as if it weren't a choice by the perpetrators. That's it for today's show. Corey War is the producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca's in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu, Gperu, Duperu, and thanks for listening.